Now more than ever, Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at Lowe's.com/lowest price guarantee.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
It's been a lot of new testimony coming out, new evidence coming out, expert witnesses saying some, depending how you take it, pretty damning things or things that raise more questions. Again, it's the two sides of this case that take every piece and go, this is great for me. I guess you can kind of, maybe, sort of, I don't know. Depending on how you want to spin it. Joining me to discuss all the latest in the trial of Karen Reed, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor. There's been a lot. Just had Dr. Isaac Wolf testifying the other day. He's the neurosurgeon who just reminded me so much of on Seinfeld, Investigator Bookman. From the library. We're just very much, yeah. What do you think about that, Jerry? But very, like, knows his stuff. I wouldn't question Dr. Bookman, and I wouldn't question Dr. Isaac Wolf, who testified. Eric, from a legal strategy perspective here, how does a defense team leverage this expert testimony when the prosecution thinks it's pretty strong? I mean, he basically said the injury to John O'Keefe's head came from falling on the back of his head, not from a strike in the front, not from a hammer, not from a fist, not from anything, but falling back on his head. What are your thoughts?
You know, that's going to be a tough one for defense to navigate because, as you know, their general theory is that John O'Keefe went into the house, there was some physical altercation, he was killed and then or injured and then brought outside in the front of the house. And so, you know, could the defense argue that, hey, there's that gash on John O'Keefe's eye, maybe he was hit in the front and that caused him to hit his head, and then he became unconscious, and they carried him out into the front yard, these cops who did this to another cop. But you can see that sort of gets attenuated and a little bit incredulous as we sort of go down that road.
A little ridiculous as it keeps going on. Yeah, I mean, I've seen the reactions from some of the FKR folks, and they immediately go to, well, the basement has a hard concrete floor. Okay. Sure, but there's no evidence pointing to him ever getting in the house, including Karen, in her own words, saying, you know, well, later she says she saw him get into the house. But initially, for the first however many weeks of this thing, there was none of that. And she found him where she thought she left him. So there's that. They can easily scream, conspiracy! That's how it is. They're covering it all up. And I guess so that's one could try to explain that, but that doesn't work in a courtroom very well. Just screaming conspiracy, everything is shady. I mean, or does it work in a courtroom?
It depends on the case, depends on the jury. But one thing as a prosecutor, when those sorts of claims would be made by defense, sometimes I would just sort of draw out all of the events that would have to occur in terms of proving that conspiracy and how implausible they were, and just say, hey, either Karen Reed is the unluckiest person in the world who is being framed and there was this massive conspiracy with all of these events that had to transpire. She did. And you know, jury, what appears to be most plausible, what appears to be the simple common sense interpretation of this evidence? And I think we're going in the direction of a conviction.
Yeah, it certainly feels that way. I mean, if you believe the experts, or if you just kind of cherry pick which ones you want to say are valid, which seems to be, you know, it happens in every case. You have the battle of the experts on both sides. Well, this one seems to say this, and I completely don't believe that one. Really, for not a lot of great reasons half the time. What did you think this week when the arguments came up about who was it? Shannon Burgess, the individual who had the timestamp data. He figured out a way to get deeper, and he very well explained it. It was boring as hell, but he very well explained how he got into the data of the Lexus and the SD card he had to find and all this stuff to pull the data to get to where he got to line the timestamps up, which just happened to look like they line up with a vehicle strike, where the vehicle says it struck something and John O'Keefe's phone stopped moving. Pretty damning. Let's talk about the actual evidence first versus the rebuttal. What do you think about those pieces?
You know, on direct examination, I really think the prosecution kind of stepped their game up in this second trial here. This is a creative, next level sort of meta-analysis between multiple electronic systems to sync up the fact that, according to the prosecution, John O'Keefe's phone, which prosecution says was outside the house, stopped having interactions with it at pretty much the exact same time that Karen Reed's vehicle was in reverse and then, you know, left the scene. You know, that pretty clearly shows that there was a vehicle strike, according to the prosecution. And I thought it was clever and compelling, at least on direct.
Clever and compelling, yes. It's, I guess, the question, and I'm sure they're going to try and raise this with the defense of, you know, well, why did this get in? They've already tried to argue, why did this get in so late? But are they going to try and go with the credibility of it? They're trying to go with the credibility of the guy, of Shannon Burgess, who delivered it, by going after his resume, where he had talked about getting a bachelor's degree. He didn't quite get the bachelor's degree. This was on his LinkedIn, and I think it was on the website, on his bio. I mean, it's not a great look. That's a T that should have been crossed and an I that should have been dotted. But we're talking about his expertise in this being certifications that really have nothing to do with his bachelor degree. This had all of his certifications that he laid out very much are in line with what you would need to come to the conclusion or to be a credible witness, expert witness, for what he is talking about here. It's a lot of noise, but is any of that going to stick with a jury? Do you think that his credibility, how successful do you think the defense was at trying to cut up his credibility, considering they didn't talk anything about the actual evidence?
You know, sometimes when you're in that gauntlet and the analysis seems pretty sound, but there's, you know, this little gift that the prosecution gives you regarding Burgess's background and his misrepresentations, you got to pounce on that and you got to try to, you know, capitalize on that and convey to this jury, Gus, this guy lied about having this bachelor's degree. Talking about an expert who has to be qualified. That's at least part of his qualifications that he's just lying to you about, jury. And so, you know, that is, I think defense made the most of it that they could, but there wasn't a very solid challenge to the science of the opinion in my prison.
Let's say, and this is just a theoretical here, had they not found that hiccup on his resume, what would they have gone after? I mean, what would they have? They definitely were struggling to find something. And then that one just kind of came to them. Here's what you should say. Here's what you should do. It was a, you know, just the golden ticket right there. But if that wasn't there, how did they counter something like that?
You know, my understanding is that there was some possible variance in sort of the numbers and the timestamps or whatever. But I think the prosecution did a pretty good job of kind of explaining the thrust of the testimony and why it matters. Absent that, blunder regarding Burgess's background, this would have been a pretty unassailable witness, I think.
Just the idea that there's a vehicle strike registering on her car in the relative same area where John O'Keefe's phone stopped working. I mean, we're talking minutes here. I mean, they got this down to like seconds now, but even within minutes, I think it would seem pretty reasonable to a juror to go, well, yeah, clocks can be off, but this thing registered a strike right around the same time his phone stopped working. I mean, unless he ran into the house and got beat up there in the course of 2 minutes and 30 seconds and was dragged back out and Karen still happened to be there. I mean, none of it makes sense. None of it would actually work for the house timeline and the whole fight theory, would it?
Not in my opinion. And really, the prosecution is doing a good job of shoring up any possible openings that the defense could try to exploit in terms of reasonable doubt. But by this, you know, precise and you know, high level technological analysis that is hard to argue with. It's based on data. You know, we're talking about when a phone says it was last used and what a car says in terms of backing in or in terms of reversing. And those things seem to line up precisely with the prosecution's theory that this was a vehicle strike. And it's really starting to dry up any grounds that the defense could try to assert in terms of closing argument. Closing argument. That's partly why the defense was so obstinate that they did not want this evidence in at this late time in the trial, because they knew it would be centrally damaging to their theory.
It is certainly centrally damaging, again, depending on how the jury takes it. Another big thing recently in the trial of Karen Reed, Hank Brennan's got the clips. He keeps going through them. And I think there's like, as we're sitting, there's like 21 or some more clips still to come. I can't wait. Because thank goodness the folks at Investigation Discovery who did the doc didn't delete their stuff from the cutting room floor. Not that you normally would, but they had the goods. I'm wondering how long they sat there thinking, gee, we might need to provide this at some point. They did a good job just on the doc, but I mean, this is like, you know, the DVD extras almost that they could have been had people still get DVDs. What else do you think, pure speculation, we're going to hear from Karen Reed before we actually talk about some of the things we did hear from Karen Reed out of her own words this week?
Gosh, you know, so far there have been clips that really show some inconsistencies. There have been statements in those clips from Karen Reed that really directly undermine the defense's theory that John O'Keefe went inside. And so, you know, what more could be coming out? I'm sure Hank Brennan has some, you know, good cards up his sleeve that he has not yet played. He has been rather masterful in his presentation, in my opinion. And I think that he's got some bangers that are just waiting to come out. Hard to say exactly what they'll be, but I think they're going to be bad for Karen Reed.
If you're the prosecutor, are you waiting till like is this like the fireworks show? Like we're seeing them popping off. Ooh, ah, that's a good one. Oh my gosh, look, it's Mickey Mouse. And then at the end, you have the finale. Are you expecting there to be a finale of clips at the very end of this where it's just going to be a damn, that was a good show?
I completely am, and that is the way to do it. You know, the prosecution has to capture this jury's attention over a long period of time. This is not a short trial, and you have to do, you know, you can't have bombshells every single day, but people develop a tolerance to that. But you've definitely got to save something for kind of a crescendo at the end. And I imagine there could even be a mashup of different statements. You know, they could play, oh, Karen Reed saying, there's no chance I hit him or whatever. And then another clip where she's saying, I could him. Yeah, I could. I wonder if they're going to contrast these discrepancies in her prior statements in some sort of mashup that just tears her apart.
Remix. They'll get a DJ in there and like, I hit him. It'll be great. It'll be the first time it's ever happened in a courtroom. What she did say this week, you know, again, through her own words, I find it very ironic. At the beginning of that documentary, she said, this is going to be my testimony. Damn right it is. It is totally your testimony. And you were not thinking when you spoke. One of the clips, she's stating flat out, we think he died around 12:25 to 12:30. That would put her there. I mean, scientifically, it puts her there. It's not an opinion. She would be there based on all of the data, based on the science of where her phone is, where her car is, where John is, where everything is. It puts her there. Why? I mean, did you take that in any other way when that was stated? We thought he died around between 12:25 and 12:30. What the hell does that mean if you're throwing all these other things out there, too?
Yeah, you know, the judge is going to instruct this jury that they do not have to leave their common sense at the door, and rather that they need to utilize that common sense. They need to draw reasonable inferences from the evidence presented, from statements from Karen Reed and from all the other witnesses. This statement seems to be a direct admission that placing her at the scene of where John O'Keefe died at the time he died, you know, she has just put her foot in her mouth repeatedly throughout the pendency of this case. And those things are going to be her death knell, I think.
How, I mean, is there any other way to take that? I'm honestly just asking. I mean, we thought, and the we is in there too. That's another question. Who's we? But but is there any other way to take it? Of, was this a statement at, like at that time we thought it was? I mean, I'm just trying to put context here where we don't really have a lot of it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's because it's said very much in a factual way, 1225 to 1230. That, of course, would mean that she was aware that he probably died after being struck by the vehicle around that time, or at least that's where she thought he stopped moving, you know, where she expected to find him and all that stuff, too. That's where we get in the closer territory to murder, too, because it's not just manslaughter anymore. If you're talking about you think you know that he was dead or dying and you left, that's not a good look.
Totally. I mean, you know, could the defense somehow rehabilitate this at some point? They certainly should try. You know, could they say that that's what Karen Reed thought at the time, and we're getting, you know, we were getting all of this information and trying to process it, trying to come to grips with this horrible tragedy, and that was her impression at one point in time. But now that we have the benefit of further defense expert analysis, we know that not to be true. You know, I think they're going to have to go down a road like that to just try to remedy some of the problems that Karen Reed has brought to her own case.
What do you think their attorneys are thinking every single day while these clips are played? I mean, they know they're out there. They know what's coming up. They have it all in discovery. But what the hell do you think's going through their mind as they try and defend her as best that they possibly can? But then at the end of the day, at the end of everything, it's boom. It's like everything you just accomplished, Karen just destroyed in a statement. What the hell are they thinking?
You know, it's kind of a thought process of almost like, who's my real adversary here? Is it the prosecution or is it my own client who keeps shooting the defense in the foot at which I'm at the helm? You know, it can be, and this is nothing new. You know, in so many cases, the defendant might do something while trial is pending or even during trial where you're just like, what in God's name are you doing? And then you have to kind of scramble and use your expertise to do your best to defend that person. Still, you have to try to bring consistency and coherence to evidence that might appear really inconsistent and incoherent.
Who's we in that statement?
Oh, no. Sweet. You know, is that it's, you know, Karen Reed wasn't married or her partner John O'Keefe died. She didn't have any children. You know, is it her and her girlfriends thought that? Maybe, but is it more likely that it's her and her defense team is the global we?
Or her dad?
I think her
dad was there. That, I mean, we have the video where it shows dad out there looking around on the ground, trying to see if he finds more tail light. I mean, I'm wondering if that's the we. I don't know. I mean, it's up for, you know, a debate, I guess, on who that could possibly be, but. Yeah, it's still kind of a mystery in that department of exactly who that could be in the we. There was other statements that were made, including outside of court. She continues to go down the road of, I saw him go in the house. She was asked that directly. Did you see him go in the house? Yes, I did. Can you describe it? No, but I'm sure they'll play it. I just don't know. I mean, what the hell, again, this kind of goes back to the attorneys. Why are they letting her speak? Or do they just have no control over their client at this point? Is this just one thing where they're like throwing their hands in the air going, she's going to do whatever she's going to do. I can't really stop her. Or I don't know. I mean, I would think you'd be trying to like go for your client's best interest. Or do they think it's in her best interest to go out there and just, you know, spew things out of her mouth every day?
You know, I'm wondering if perhaps the defense team was looking at this like, hey, when Karen Reed start when this case heated up, got a lot of public attention, Karen Reed got some momentum. And then when she started interacting with her followers and her supporters, that momentum grew. And for a time, it seemed like sort of the media machine that Karen Reed was fueling was helping them. And so perhaps that's the sort of track that the defense got in and said, hey, I'll keep doing this. It's good. But then it starts to kind of go off course, and then it sort of spirals down the hill. And perhaps defense is just sort of still in that car and couldn't reverse course at that point. And you know, now, for example, if they prevented her from talking, that would be that would raise a ton of red flags. People would be like, hey, what's going on? How come Karen Reed isn't doing what she's been doing? Mm-hmm. Really, the almost the entire pendency of the case.
But wouldn't that be better, though? I mean, rather than continuing to cause more damage. I mean, yes, it would look weird. There's been some days where she clearly gets out there and looks rather frazzled. She had some of those moments this week, calling the testimony of Burgess, what was it, extraordinary? Or she initially said something of that nature. She praised it, and then she pulled back going, it was like the opposite. Again, I forgot her exact terminology of what she used, but she didn't have the words that she normally does. She came out there, and you could tell, she was kind of like deer in a headlight a little bit, not having any comments about her own comments, the clips that were played in court that day or the timestamp, and also frazzled when asked about that. Do you think she's starting to feel the writing on the wall here? Do you think she herself is feeling like she's being backed into the corner? And do you think the defense team is starting to feel that way, too?
You know, yes. And I think leading up to this retrial, some would say Karen Reed was kind of brazen. She was kind of audacious. She was kind of out there. You know, she's talking and she seems to be enjoying the media attention and being her version of charismatic. And then once you get into that gauntlet, things change. Sometimes the gravity of what is going on in that courtroom and the direction it's going can sort of land in your chest and you feel it. And I can't help but wonder if Karen Reed is like, hey, this isn't going like the first one went.
I wonder, do you think she's had a moment or do you think it's just been kind of a slow build lobster in the pot? I wonder if there's one thing that was just like, I mean, she's had her reactions in court. That's certainly there where it's, you can tell she's not happy about some of the rulings that have come down and what's been played in court. But I'm wondering, I don't know. I mean, was there a moment or just a slow build on this one?
You know, I think there could have been a few moments. Yeah. One was the digital forensics expert who did a locational analysis of John O'Keefe's phone and at least for the most part said that it was very likely to be outside of the home, though there was some cross-examination. And then on top of that, I think Burgess's testimony was problematic for the defense. There was a recent forensic criminalist on the stand who purported to match up some of the plastic debris found on John O'Keefe with the broken taillight from Karen Reed's vehicle. And so I can't help but wonder if these, you know, high points for the prosecution are starting to kind of punch Karen Reed in the gut and she's starting to really come to grips with what's happened.
And they're really going into detail this round and really explaining not just, okay, the expert says that these microscopic pieces of taillight were found in his clothing, as you just mentioned there, Christina Hanley, the forensic trace expert that was testifying the other day, but going into just how detailed that these things were in there, basically stating to a layperson, there's no way you're going to be able to plant these things this way. I mean, it's just, you're not. It's just, it's not going to look like this. You'd have to literally, it would have to come at you in a certain way and a certain volition and a certain energy force to get these things embedded into the clothing at the microscopic level that they were. Not exactly the, well, let's take some chunks of taillight and plant it over here, that whole theory. But again, there doesn't seem to be anything that the defense won't try to believe, that the cops somehow microscopically planted tiny shards of taillight in his clothing. Okay, if you want to believe that, that's lovely, but I'm going to say it's probably not true. How that was a damning piece, I thought, as well, especially just to a jury that doesn't know the full breadth of this case as the rest of us do, you know, supposedly. But they're hearing that for the first time. They're hearing the timestamp matches up. They're hearing the hatred that Karen seemed to have for him in those voicemails. They're hearing her basically admit to the timestamps matching where she thought he died. And now we have pieces of the damn broken taillight in his clothes. This is not, I mean, this is not a real complicated whodunit here. This is more like, wake up.
Yeah, I feel you. And you know, I think it's in part a function of the new special prosecutor, Hank Brennan, and the tight ship that he has been at the helm of during this retrial. You know, in the first trial, there were a lot of sense. There were dots that weren't always connected. And so I think Hank Brennan saw that and he said, hey, how do we overcome this conspiracy argument? How do we present a more ironclad a coherent story to this jury so they can understand and believe what we're telling them happened? And I think he's done a really good job of that, like you said, going into detail about the nuance, about sort of the smaller aspects that when, you know, looked at under a microscope, really kind of help show that there's no opening for reasonable doubt in a lot of those analyses.
Obviously, it's the job of her defense to introduce reasonable doubt. That seems to be probably the only way she's going to be getting off here, is trying to find some shard, it's pardon the pun, of reasonable doubt that maybe will resound with something. But you have to walk that fine line when you're a defense attorney of not insulting the intelligence of the jurors, I would think, because nothing kills anybody liking you faster is, you know, insulting their intelligence, or even worse, doing it in a real kind of covert way, passive aggressive way, where we're not going to quite tell you you're an idiot, but we think you might be an idiot, so we're gonna frame it this way, even though you're not an idiot. One of those things I thought was interesting, the way that the defense was trying to introduce reasonable doubt into the taillight shards, was the stressing that you can't say conclusively, I believe, that these shards of taillight embedded in his clothes came from this specific taillight. They're the same type of plastic. They're the same color of the taillight. They look like they could be, but there's no way to like forensically put them together like a puzzle because they're just tiny little pieces. And really stressing that, I felt that, I mean, I get what they're doing, but was that the right road to go down to say, well, yes, it could, it's the same make, it's the same this and that, but it could have been another Lexus SUV of the exact same make and model that maybe slammed into John O'Keefe and implanted these pieces into his clothing. That could be a possibility, right? That's where the word reasonable comes into play when it comes to reasonable doubt.
Exactly. I mean, you got to be careful on the defense side with what you're trying to sell to a jury, because they don't want their intelligence insulted. You know, think about if you're like at work and there's some kind of dispute and the first person says, you know, hey, yeah, that this guy was making me feel uncomfortable and harassing me. And then the guy says, actually, it was a complete body double. And you can't prove that I don't have a twin or that I haven't been cloned or something. You know, you got to, well, that might be theoretically true.
Yeah.
Is that really what you want to try to sell to a jury? And could that damage your own credibility by making that argument?
Walk me through, because I'm trying to figure out Karen's argument on the piece of glass that was, or some of the pieces of glass that were found on her bumper and the taillight, that they're not pieces of glass that fit into the puzzle physically of the drinking glass. They're tiny shards. So they're pieces, again, that really can't be quite placed as to where they are. Now, granted, it's already been said that John O'Keefe left the car basically with two drinks, from what we understand. Her vodka tonic, and essentially he had one too. That's from all of the minutiae what I think many of us have come to conclude. Maybe if it's just one, it doesn't, not whatever it may be. What does it matter at this point if there's shards of glass that maybe couldn't be found to be put into the puzzle of the broken glass? Is there another mystery glass we're talking about? Is it the second glass? What? Because Karen seems to be stuck on this, too, when out of court the other day making some statements of, well, they didn't know where that glass was from. What? Okay. And I mean, maybe I'm missing this here. What's the argument?
You know, it's a bit of a head scratch on that one. The argument might be, let me just try to muck up the facts here as best I can.
Yeah.
And hopefully that will lead to some confusion that might translate into reasonable doubt. Because, yeah, you know, if there was a second glass, I don't know, is defense going to argue that the Alberts, you know, beat John O'Keefe with multiple glasses? It really starts to unravel and fall apart when you scrutinize it. And that's the problem for Karen Reed's defense.
Because this mystery glass really doesn't have anything to do with anything. Nobody's saying he got hit in the head with a glass. I mean, there's the neurosurgeon said, look, this injury is from falling on the back of his head. It's not from a glass being chopped at his head, because there's no contusion like you'd have with a hammer or a flying cocktail glass. So I don't know where the glass is from. If I guess one could possibly assume that the glass is from the drinking glass. It's just shards that you can't really place. Again, what does it matter? It has nothing to do. Again, it's look, there's fire over here. Look over here. Glass, shiny. Don't pay attention to this. Is that really what we're dealing with on the glass right now?
It could be that. It could be something like, hey, the prosecution has a duty to explain to you what happened and to explain what the evidence is and where it comes from. And if there are things they can't explain, that's a problem. And that could lead to some kind of doubt, and that could translate into reasonable doubt. I suspect it's going to be some kind of vague argument like that, saying, hey, prosecution has the responsibility of telling you what happened here and what this stuff is, and they can't do it, so don't trust them on other stuff.
Would her better of option had just been to kind of, if in fact she's guilty, if she knew about this, just to have said, look, I was drunk. This was horrible. I feel horrible. Not intentional. And have pled something early on versus this. I mean, if you're to look back in time, what would you have said to her?
You know, I think that this, from defense perspective, could easily be characterized as just a horribly tragic accident. That it's something that no one intended. You know, horrible stuff happens. It was a blizzard out, that they were engaged in this sort of chaotic conflict. Emotions are running high, and something really horrible happened. And you know, to try to broker a plea before the first trial, or even possibly better, after the mistrial, because then defense has some leverage to say, hey, y'all don't, you know, you weren't able to bring it home the first time. You might not be able to bring it home the second time. Let's meet in the middle somewhere. You know, give her 2 years in jail or something and call it good. I wonder if that was explored. I don't know.
Well, the consequences will be faced shortly, and that may be freedom, or it may be a lot longer behind bars.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.